court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia. Welcome to Court Appointed, Two Dudes' Perspective on Legal Frivolity. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude.
How are you doing today, Tommy?
Pretty good. How about you, old buddy?
Not too bad. I had a what I thought was going to be kind of a slow day at the office, but ended up kind of ramping up rather quickly with an emergency client coming in right before we recorded.
An emergency client? The ambulance delivered him right to your door?
That's right.
You didn't have to chase the ambulance? They delivered him to your door?
He had a wallet stuck on his butt. And they're like, we need him to move the wallet from his butt.
An emergency buttectomy.
No, they have a hearing tomorrow. So I was like, well, I got to get ready for that. So
wow. You're like the one-stop shop. You're like the 7-Eleven of lawyers, huh? When it's late at night and you got the cravings for munchies and you can go to 7-Eleven, you're just like that lawyer there hanging out on the street corner that you can go grab, huh?
That's right. Come to my office. I'll be there.
I sleep there behind the desk.
Yeah, usually during the day, though. I have, especially now I've gotten a little bit older, I have been known to nod off occasionally after lunch sitting in my desk chair.
Man, you already get that. That's what energy drinks are for.
Oh, I don't touch that.
I keep them stocked in my refrigerator. Otherwise, I'd be done before noon.
That stuff scares me. It makes my heart hurt.
Well, I got myself started on it with Red Bulls and vodka.
Oh, yeah. Liquid cocaine. That's what that is.
It's legal.
It is legal.
It may not be smart, but it's legal.
The thing is, I can't have caffeine in the afternoon or I'll be up all night, too.
Are you serious? I could drink a cup of coffee before going to bed and it wouldn't bother me.
Not me. It keeps me up all night.
I sleep like a dead person.
Yeah. Good to know. get the mirror. Is Tommy sleeping? Or is he dead? We don't know.
Well, with my CPAP mask on, you at least it'll be pumping away there still.
Well, this episode is going to be on contract law. I kind of have an affinity for contract law. It's pretty dry and boring for the most part, but I think there's also some really kind of interesting facets of it as well. So,
is this like when you take a contract out on somebody to have them bumped off?
That's right. You get Agent 66 to step in. He comes in and performs a contract. I think that's a video game reference. I played that game, but I don't really remember it. There's also a movie.
I'm not much of a video gamer, so that would go right by me. I remember that one that you all used to play, GoldenEye.
Oh, yeah.
Was it? And he'd walk around as one of those first-person shooter games, I think they call them, or something like that?
Yeah, that was actually probably the one of the very first-person shooter games.
I used to get vertigo from trying to walk around and the way it would spin you around. And look, I couldn't do that. I said, there must be something to do with older people that it affects them because younger people just eat it up.
I got pretty good at that game because I memorized all the maps, and I would see on everyone else's screen where they were. And I knew the best way to get behind them and go shoot them in the back.
I couldn't figure out anything. I kept shooting myself in the face. I don't know. I've turned the gun on myself. I don't even know how. Or drop a bomb and blow myself up or something. I don't know.
Step on a proximity mine in the complex?
Yeah, or something. All I know is I did not do well in that. I just go hide in a corner.
I love that game. I tried to play it not too long ago with Skittles Joe. We tried to play it.
Yeah.
And I don't really like the controls in it anymore because they've kind of changed the way you play first-person shooters where you have two thumbsticks now, so
right.
You can strafe. Mm-hmm. The Nintendo only has one thumbstick, so it's a little weird.
Wow, so, no strafing. What fun is that?
I know. I got to have my strafe. Got to get my strafe on. So, as I said, this episode is going to be on contract law. And one of the areas, I mean, we could probably do multiple podcasts on contract law because it's a pretty in-depth subject. And in law school, one of the harder classes, and it's like you always take contract law your first year, and that's one of the classic fundamental law school classes you take. And it was quite terrifying as a first-year law student to be sitting in a contracts class because basically you fill out a note card, at least in most law schools, you fill out a note card with your name on it, and you give it to the professor, and the professor just randomly calls on people to answer questions. And so it's pretty terrifying.
That same professor that we talked about in the live show?
I say, bring it up to the front and present your case to me, Mr. Meadows.
No, but he did wear a bow tie and have little circular horn-rimmed glasses.
See, that's what I figured.
Yeah.
That's the way they all look.
Pretty much.
You know, we've talked before, we said that death and taxes are the only two sure things in life, but probably entering into a contract is also another thing. At some point in your life, everybody will enter into a contract of some type.
Oh, there's no doubt. I mean, whether it's a lease for an apartment or a house or
a car, a house.
I mean, you're going to have a contract at some point. You know, if you're renting out a venue to have a podcast festival. I was going to say a sausage party. Well, you get around and eat sausages.
That's on the menu at Bonhoff's.
That's right.
I'll have one sausage party to go.
You got to have the sausage parties upstairs, sir.
But you're right. You're always going to have, at some point, you're going to enter into a contract. When you're forming a contract, there generally has to be what's called a meeting of the minds. Sometimes there's not a meeting of the minds, and sometimes people make mistakes whenever they're forming the contract. Now, for the purposes of contract law, a mistake basically means an erroneous belief that a certain set of facts are true. And mistake can be used as a defense to the enforcement of a contract and can actually lead to a contract being void ab initio.
Void ab initio?
Yep. And that basically means that the contract is treated as invalid from the outset of signing it, or voidable. And the main difference between the two is that a void ab initio contract cannot be performed under the law, while a voidable contract can still be performed, although the unbound party to the contract can choose to void it before the other party performs. So there's one contract that is basically delusion.
Well, we're 5 minutes in and I'm lost.
Well, there's one contract that is basically...
Doesn't take much.
Well, it puts you back into basically where you were before the contract even started.
But now, you said it was a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean that the way the contract was written was not what the two parties intended, that somebody made a mistake in the writing of it? I mean, what are we saying? There was this mistake, or somebody stated that they had something that they didn't have, so they couldn't rightfully sell it? Or what do we mean?
Well, there's some sort of misunderstanding in the belief that somebody has in what they're selling or what they're contracting for. They just don't understand. There's not a meeting of the minds, so to speak.
Somebody now doesn't have the ability to fulfill their end of the contract one way or another.
Right. Yeah. It could be one party or it could be both parties.
So does it matter if it's intentional or unintentional? I mean, does it have to be unintentional, be a mistake? Because if it's intentional, it's fraud, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, that would be considered, it'd be fraud. Because it has to be unintentional in order to be a mistake.
So it'd be like, I sold him the car. I thought I owned the car. I mean, maybe I didn't own the car. I raced him for his pink slip. But I guess you can't do that anymore, you know? Greece is over, so I thought that's how it worked.
I think you have your pink slip on your cell phone now, so, I mean, it's all virtual these days. It's like tickets to the movies and plane tickets, you know, it's just show your cell phone.
Oh, okay.
I Bluetoothed him my pink slip, so it's not my car anymore.
Yeah, isn't that good? He gave it to me. It's on the back of a beer label.
I file shared it with him. So at common law, and this is where I'm going to get into a bit more about mistake, so maybe this will clear it up a little bit.
Okay.
But at common law, there's different types of mistakes. There's unilateral mistakes and there's mutual mistakes. So unilateral basically means that one party is the one who misunderstood it. Mutual means both parties don't understand what's going on. As I said, the unilateral is where one party makes a mistake. These don't generally make a contract void, due to the theories of what we've talked about before, caveat emptor and caveat venditor, which is let the buyer beware and let the seller beware respectively. So if you kind of have a unilateral mistake, it's almost like in public policy, it's almost like, well, you know, you are an adult, you are a company, you should have read the contract or you should have understood what was going on beforehand. So under those two theories of let the buyer or let the seller beware, really, unilateral contracts are not generally voidable unless there's some sort of something else going on. You know, like you had said, like if there was a fraud or something along those lines. This takes us to mutual mistake. And this is where both parties to a contract are mistaken about the same material fact within the contract. And that makes the contract itself voidable.
Nobody knows what's going on, huh?
Yeah, everybody's like, whoa, I don't know what's going on. What are we doing here? I don't know. If the mistake is to a collateral issue, and by a collateral issue, I mean something that is not to the heart of the contract, then there is no right to rescission of the contract. That means it's not voidable. If the mutual mistake goes to the heart of the contract, it's basically an essential term of the contract, and these are material terms which have not been agreed to, essentially, then it is something that can be voided. So if there's a mutual mistake to something that's basically the main part, the meat and potatoes of the contract.
So if I get this right, the collateral, to me, collateral means money or financial.
No, that's not what it means.
Oh, okay. Because I thought maybe that meant somebody agreed to buy something and didn't have the money, and that's not an excuse to, you know, to void the contract.
No, a collateral issue would be something that is not really germane to the contract itself. It's something that's kind of secondary or tertiary. It's like not a main thing. It doesn't mean that it's not a mistake as to the goods or the price or the method of delivery, for the most part, I think would be the main things that are the meat and potatoes of the contract.
Well, I told you before we started this subject that I had no idea what we were talking about, so I'm fulfilling my end of this agreement. I still have no idea. I tell you, the mistake I make is not a unilateral or a mutual. It's a common mistake. That's what I'm guilty of. I used to get that in school all the time. Well, Mr. Schmerl, that's wrong. That's a common mistake.
Make no mistake, I have no idea what you're talking about.
That's right.
Well, one of the reasons I really wanted to get into this area of contract law is because it has to do with probably one of my, top five cases I've ever read in law school.
Is it better than Pig Boy?
I don't think I read Pig Boy in law school.
Oh, we just talked about
we
that
just talked about it. Yeah.
I like the Pig Boy case.
I mean, there's other cases I like, but this is one of those ones that's kind of emblazoned in my memory is in law school from being tortured in contracts class.
But, blazing lawyers.
Yeah. This case is called Raffles.
Lawyers.
Raffles v. Lawyers.
Lawyers, lawyers.
Lawyer, it's hard.
Liars.
Raffles v. Wickelhaus. And
this Raffles is, v. Wickelhaus?
Yeah, and this case is sometimes called the Peerless case.
Wasn't Winklevoss. It wasn't those twins at it again, was it?
It was not the Winklevoss.
The Winklevi.
As I said, you read this case in your first year of law school, and I really always liked it, and for a couple reasons. Number one is because the facts are kind of funny and ironic, I think. And number two, it was really short.
Oh.
It was one of those 20-page cases you have to read. In law school, whenever you have these cases, you have to do what's called briefing them. Mm-hmm. So you have to read the case and then prepare a brief for it. And that's when you get called on. You basically read your brief to the professor, and they usually tell you why you're wrong.
I just show my brief to the professor.
That is frowned upon. One time in class.
Is it frowned upon or against the rules?
It's probably against the rules, too. One time in class, my contacts started messing up, and I was kind of rubbing my eye, and the professor called on me while I was doing that, and I said, sorry, professor, my contacts bugging me. He goes, oh, I know. That's why I called on you. It's like, oh, my gosh. These people are...
Thank you.
They're horrible. So, the Peerless case. The year was 1864, and Wickelhaus contracted with Raffles to purchase some cotton.
You had to go into your 1864 voice, I see.
I'm setting the scene.
Okay.
I'm just basically going to read the case itself because the language is pretty good in it, too.
The Civil War's been progressing well. Thought I'd add to your ambience.
Well, this case took place in England as well, so it's not.
So they wouldn't be talking about the Civil War,
no,
would they?
No, probably not.
Oh, so we're back in England, jolly old England again.
Yeah, we're back in jolly old England.
Jolly old England.
So the plaintiff should sell to the defendants, and the defendant should buy of the plaintiff certain goods, to wit, 125 bales of Surat cotton, guaranteed middling fair merchants Dolora, to arrive ex-peerless, meaning ex-peerless meaning to arrive via the peerless, from Bombay, and that the cotton should be taken from the quay, and that the defendant would pay the plaintiff for the same at a certain rate, to wit, at the rate of 17d per pound, within certain time, then agreed upon after the arrival of said goods in England. Averments that the said goods did arrive by the said ship from the Bombay in England, to wit, at Liverpool, and the plaintiff was then and there ready and willing and offered to deliver the said goods to defendants. The breach was that the defendants refused to accept the said goods or pay the plaintiff for them. Plea, that the said ship method mentioned in the said agreement was meant and intended by the defendants to be the ship called the Peerless, which sailed from Bombay, to wit, in October, and that the plaintiff was not ready and willing and did not offer to deliver to the defendants any bales of cotton which arrived by the last mentioned ship, but instead thereof was only ready and willing and offered to deliver to the defendants 125 bales of Surat cotton, which arrived by another and different ship, which was also called the Peerless, and which sailed from Bombay to it in December. So that's the case right there.
Well, now, I wish that we could just have a show of hands. How many people out there in Radio Land followed that?
Let me break it down for
I'm
you.
I'm completely lost. I mean, only because I kind of stumbled across the thing before. Do I have any idea what you just said?
Well, let me break it down. These two companies, or these two people, Raffles and Wickelhaus, they basically entered a contract to buy 125 bales of cotton, of Surat cotton from Bombay. Mm-hmm. And they agreed that they agreed on the price, the name of the ship, how much it was, what kind it was, the quality of it, everything. And it was going to be shipped from Bombay to Liverpool aboard the ship called Peerless. Well, as luck would have it, there were two ships called Peerless, which were sailing from Bombay to Liverpool. The one party thought they meant the October Peerless ship, but the other party thought that they meant the December Peerless ship.
All right, so the receiver had to have been the one looking for it then in October.
That's right.
Went to the dock. The Peerless shows up, and he says, "What are you hanging around the docks for?" "Well, I want my, what was
Surat
it?
Cotton.
Cotton,
of,
yeah.
My Surat cotton of guaranteed middling fair merchants, Delora."
Whatever that means. Yeah. "I want my cotton, and I'm here to get it." "We don't have any cotton for you. We've just got spices on there. We just came from, where did we come from?"
Bombay.
"Dr. Bombay sent us, and we got spices from Bombay. We don't have, where's my cotton?" Yeah. But you can't pick up the phone in those days and call and say, "Where's my cotton, huh?"
No, you can't. And it's just like, well, there's a ship here called the Peerless.
So probably what he did is he went about and procured some cotton from somewhere else.
Yeah, and that would actually be called, in contract law, that'd be called a cover. So
he went and procured some cotton. Then lo and behold, in December, another ship shows up called the Peerless.
Exactly.
And they're calling, they're saying, "Hey, send a runner over there to so-and-so's house," whichever one was one buying this stuff. "Hey, we're here with his cotton. He's got to come pick it up. We got to get this stuff out of here. I got to get home."
That's right.
And he said, "Oh no, my cotton was supposed to have been here in October. That's somebody else's cotton."
Yep. And essentially, since there's no meeting of the minds and there was a mutual mistake, there was no contract because they did not, one of the essential terms, there was no meeting of the minds about.
Well, they both were right.
In their own minds.
And they both were wrong.
Exactly.
So everybody did everything they were supposed to do, but the deal fell through.
Pretty much, yeah. But I just love the fact that both the ships were called the Peerless. And that's just.
And they were not.
No, they were not.
They had a peer.
They did.
Each other. Is there any kind of ship registry somewhere where it says, "No, that name's used. You can't have that"?
I don't know. Maybe.
There should be if there's not.
If I had a boat, I would want to call it the C word.
The C word? You saw that on TV the other night. What show were we watching that was on?
Well, I think it's on Arrested Development.
There was a show I was watching the other night, and that was on there. They were going to get on a ship. Oh, I know what it was. Last Man on Earth.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's about the same kind of humor.
They were going to pick out a boat that they were going to go out to sea on, and there was one that was that. I can't remember what the other one was, but it was the same type of thing. But that was definitely one of them.
Yeah. Spelled S-E-A space mm-hmm. word. Mm-hmm. The C word.
Yeah.
Get it?
I get it.
But yeah, that was one of my favorite cases from law school. That's one of them right there. So
the whole thing just comes down to ambiguity.
Yeah, kind of. A bit of ambiguity. That's why whenever you have a contract, you want to make sure it's super specific and super locked down, because otherwise.
Well, I don't understand why somewhere in there it wouldn't have said when the date was that it was going to arrive or something.
Well, I mean, if you think about the time period, you don't know how long it took to get from Bombay to Liverpool in 1864, 1865.
Well, you probably knew within less than 3 months.
I don't know. I mean, they were looking for the passage going the other direction, 100, 200 years before that? Well, I guess it was maybe in the 1495 when Columbus sailed the ocean blue. Yeah, there you go.
1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue.
Or 1492, 95, whatever. It was a long year. It was a long trip. But yeah, So, yeah, I think there was a lot of variables. As
GPS
far as,
wasn't very accurate, huh?
No. I think there's a lot of variables.
Variables and audibles.
Yeah. Who knows how long it took to get there?
Well.
So, I don't think they were able to lock it down.
And there was no way to communicate, I guess.
No. You just, pick up the phone. The phone said, call Bombay. Hey, we're
Bombay,
calling.
Bombay, we're calling you from Liverpool. The Beatles aren't here yet, but we're wondering where the cotton is.
We need some of your sapphire gin. What's going on over there? We're fine here. How are you?
We have tubs of cinnamon spice you sent us, and that's not what we were looking for.
Well, that, it's funny, too, because at that time, England, with the East India Trading Company, they had tons of shipping going back and forth. That was huge. That was one. I think that was the biggest company in the world at that time. So there was a lot. That was a pretty frequent trade route, I believe.
That's where the India Pale Ale came from.
I read that, and they put the extra hops in there allegedly to try to keep it
Make it last. And that's where the IPAs, and that's why IPAs have the stronger hops.
I think I read somewhere that was actually false, though. That was
a
common misconception.
I was going to say, that's what I've always understood.
Yeah.
In my beer history.
Well, let's just
beer history askew.
Let's just go with it. I like that. I like the story.
Well, I like it, too. It makes sense.
It does make sense,
I still don't care much for IPAs, though.
I do. I like
regardless of what the story is.
I'm kind of a little burned out on IPAs now. I was, for a period there, I was really, really into the IPAs and really getting down on them. But anymore, I kind of burn out. I think I burned
my... getting down on the IPAs. Huh?
I definitely was.
Down with that.
One of my favorites was Ruination by Stone Brewing.
Yeah.
It was a double IPA, I think. And man, it was like 7.9% or something. It was a strong beer. And it only comes in 22 ounces.
Hmm.
Usually the big bottles. So
kind of like the Foster's comes in the oil can.
Exactly. But not really, because it's much better. Hmm. Well, are there any motions today?
As a matter of fact, I have a motion to approach the bench to pay for court costs.
You may approach. So, you know what is truly peerless, Tommy?
What's peerless, Mike?
Dollar Shave Club is peerless.
You are correct. And you know what, Mike? We've done their ads several times here. And, you know, we've of course, they send us some copy that they want us to read along. But the truth is, you and I have both use the razor.
Oh, yeah.
And the shave butter.
Yes, sir.
And we don't need to read this to know that what they offer is an exceptional value and an exceptional product.
It is. As they say, I mean, it really is the smarter choice because it works great. You get a great shave at a great price, conveniently delivered to your door.
And the shave butter itself, it just really does a good job. I changed out the razor. It's not just for men either. This is for women as well. I changed out the razor, and I told Mary I wanted her to try it,
mm-hmm.
my wife, in case you didn't know. And
my sister.
She took it in there. That's correct. And she took it in the
That's
shower
his wife,
with her.
My
and
sister.
She used it, and she said, "What is that in that tube?" And I said, "Well, it's shave butter." And she said, "Well, is it a soap product?" I said, "No, it's some kind of butter." And she said, "What?" And I said, "Well, I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't put it on my corn or my dinner roll, but it's some kind of something smooth and it's clear.
Yeah.
And you can see what you're doing when you're shaving.
That's the coolest part. You can see what you're doing.
And I mean, I truthfully did not even think the razor was working because I have always, when I've shaved, you always feel the tugging and the pulling.
Yep.
As you do it, hopefully you don't cut yourself. On this, it just felt like you were just dragging the weight across you, and it did a great job. I mean, it does a really good shave.
Whenever I think about shaving, you talk about pulling and whatever. I remember my health teacher from high school was Mr. Oliver, and I remember he had a big nose, and he always joke about his big nose. And he said he's talking about shaving. He's
a great guy.
Oh, he's really funny. He was a great guy. His wife was a counselor too. She was my counselor. They're good people. Anyway, he would always say, I hate shaving. I'd rather take a punch in my big old nose than shave because it hurts. I was just thinking to myself, I bet Mr. Oliver tried the old Dollar Shave Club and the shave butter. He probably wouldn't want to punch himself in the nose anymore.
Well, you should send him one as a gift with as inexpensive as they are.
That's right.
I mean, it would be a great gift to send somebody. And then once you start out with it, then from then on, you just need to have the cartridges sent each month, and they're just for dollars. I mean, it's really easy, and I hate having to keep up with, because you wait till your razor's worn out, then you got to go get some, and maybe you go a few days longer with the old razor than you should have because you didn't have new ones. This solves that problem because they send them right to your door.
Absolutely. And right now, for a limited time, new members get their first month of the Executive Razor with a tube of their Dr. Carver's Shave Butter for only $5 with free shipping. After that, razor's a few bucks a month.
Your first month box, you get the awesome weighty handle, a full cassette of four cartridges, and a tube of the Shave Butter. There's no hidden fees, no commitments, and you can cancel anytime you like.
Join the club today at dollarshaveclub.com/court.
That's dollarshaveclub.com/court. Mike and I would not steer you wrong. We wouldn't endorse this product if we didn't like it, and it's fantastic.
It is. I love Dollar Shave Club. Well, generally, whenever you are talking about contracts, you look to the four corners of the contract to interpret the terms. When I say the four corners of the contract, that's a term that gets thrown out a lot in the legal world, whether it's talking about contracts or a complaint or something like that. And basically, it just means whatever's written on the paper is within the four corners of the contract.
So you have to dig deep, huh?
Dig deep. If the contract has an integration clause or a merger clause, which most do, then basically that's a clause in the contract which says that something along the lines that basically the written agreement is the complete agreement between the parties, and anything not included in the writing is not a part of the contract. So basically, if you're agreeing to something, it needs to be in that writing within the four corners of the contract.
So in other words, don't assume something is covered. Make sure it's specifically spelled out.
Exactly. Now, sometimes, though, it's necessary to look outside the four corners of the contract to interpret the different terms. When this occurs, basically what is used is called the parole evidence rule. The term parole, and that's a legal term of art, it means word, and it comes from the French word, which basically is derived from a Latin term, parabola, speech, or meaning word. So basically it has nothing to do with like parole, like you're getting paroled from jail. It's more has to do with the French word parole, which means word. The parole evidence rule is basically you're looking to words outside the contract.
Okay, now I'm really lost. Go right ahead.
Well, whenever you have
the word means word. The word parole means word, and it's from the Latin word parabola, which means word.
Speech.
Speech.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, anyway,
I go along with you there, counselor, because I'm thoroughly confused at this point anyway.
It's P-A-R-O-L, whereas the other term is P-R-O-L-E, that's a criminal portion of it. So,
right.
So it's just a different term. It doesn't mean the same thing. I just wanted to really make that clear.
That's what they let you out on and give you a nice ankle bracelet, something like that.
Sometimes you go to the day report center with your ankle bracelet. So the parole evidence rule is applied differently in a lot of states. Some states are called four corner states, again, the four corners thing, and meaning that parole evidence is almost always barred. That's kind of a minority. Most places generally follow what's called, it's under the UCC, which stands for the Uniform Commercial Code, and that's been adopted in a number of states. The UCC has Rule 2/202, and generally, parole evidence cannot be used to contradict a writing intended to be the final expression of the agreement integrated, but may be explained or supplemented by a course of dealing, usage of trade, course of performance, and by evidence of consistent additional terms, unless the writing was also intended to be a complete and exclusive statement of the terms of the agreement. So basically, you can use parole evidence in certain limited circumstances to interpret the contract.
Now what I heard you say was, all right, the contract would spell something out, and whatever it says stands, and the parole or word evidence would be like, say you'd already been performing under this contract, same contract for a couple of years.
Right.
And the way you did it, no one had ever taken exception to. Now you've re-signed the contract and they're wanting you to do something different than what you've done for the last 2 years.
Right.
And you would say, well, general understanding, this is the way we've done it. We didn't change anything in the contract. Why do I need to change what I'm doing?
Yeah, exactly. You could use that as parole evidence. But they're also, you might have a waiver and estoppel argument in that situation too, which is a different subject. But yeah, that's kind of the same thing. This 2202 can basically be used to say like, well, we never had a contract, but it's common practice in the industry that this is what this term means in the industry. So therefore that's what it means. And using that rule, it can be interpreted for that. So the UCC is always wants to find a contract and always tries to, I think, kind of avoid trickery and chicanery and all those kinds of things. So,
and vagary.
And vagary.
Not vagrancy.
And no buggery.
No buggery. That used to be a hanging offense.
Yeah.
In jolly old England.
So.
Oh, Schmedley, did you hear what he got into?
Schmedley got hung. Didn't we do this bit already?
I think so.
Yeah, okay. Well, it's important, and the reason I really wanted to talk about the parole evidence rule, too, because it kind of plays in with the whole stake, because, you know, you don't have a meeting in the minds of the contract, and there's vague terms in the contract, but the parole evidence rule can really be a big trap for consumers or anybody that's buying anything out there in different instances, because basically the contract is the four corners of the contract and not what anybody says ahead of time. So some of the areas where this can be really tricky is health club contracts. So basically, if you enroll in a health club and the salesperson tells you that the contract can be canceled, and then later you decide you want to cancel, but the written contract says that it's not cancelable, you can't cancel it. The oral promises of that salesperson.
Well, the guy at the front desk said I could.
Yeah. Those oral promises are not enforceable. So, I mean, you could try to argue a misrepresentation by the guy, but really, you don't want to be the one arguing that. You want to have it in writing, what it says. Auto sales agreements. So basically, if you purchase like a used car and the guy's like, oh, it's as good as new, but it's sold as is, and then you drive it off the lot and it breaks, then again, the contract controls it. So
caveat emptor.
Exactly. Caveat emptor. Now, sometimes this is considered puffing or puffery is another legal term.
Puffery?
Yeah, puffery. And
that's on the flip side of buggery.
Yeah. And basically, puffery is generally allowed. And
doesn't sound like it should be. It doesn't have to do with vaping, right?
It's defined as kind of like as exaggerated or false praise, and it's deemed to basically say, like, these terms are frequently used to denote an exaggerations reasonably to be expected of a seller to the degree of the quality of his product, the truth or falsity of which cannot be precisely determined. So it's basically like
I have never had a car on the lot that was in as good a shape as this car right here. When you buy this, you'll be buying the best car I have ever sold.
Yeah, you are puffing away right there, my friend.
And you can't prove that otherwise, right?
Yeah. What's that drip coming from underneath there? That's just sweat from the horsepower.
That's just an air conditioner.
I like sweat from the horsepower.
Okay, we'll use that. That's the pee bag leaking. It's got a built-in catheter.
It's got a Mr. Thirsty.
Good for long trips.
It's got a Mr. Thirsty, like the space shuttles.
Yeah.
So,
this makes me think a lot, though, about last week's episode with the releases and everything.
Yeah.
That they hand you this contract and they say, here, just sign that. Well, what does it say? Oh, it just says this, this, and this. Oh, okay. So you sign it. It's too bad. What's in the four corners is what counts. It doesn't matter what this guy that handed you this thing to sign says. Oh, it just says it's okay for us to do this. Oh, okay.
Yeah, I know. And that's why whenever I get handed one of those things, they're like, oh, here's basically what it says. And I say, I appreciate you telling me what it says, but
I'm going to read it.
I'm going to go and read it and see what it actually says, not your interpretation of what it says.
Because I'm a lawyer. I'm not your run-of-the-mill schmo here.
I don't say that. I'll say, I'm a lawyer, so I'm going to read this.
Let me get out my reading glasses and get my secretary in here.
Hold on while I fix this bow tie.
That's right.
No,
and put it in my funny voice. I was talking like this when it came in. Now I'm talking like this because it's my lawyer voice.
Now I try to avoid saying that I'm a lawyer. So.
I'm an attorney.
Yeah, there. Lawyer.
Lawyer.
Law. I'm a lawyer. Is that how you say it?
Lawyer.
Lawyer.
Whatever you say, half the people are going to say you're saying it wrong.
I don't know. You know one word I say wrong? And I'm kind of embarrassed about.
What's that?
It's a state.
Washington?
No, I say Washington fine.
There's a lot of people around here that say Washington.
Washington? No.
It's Washington.
No. I for some reason, I don't even understand what I'm saying that's wrong. I say Connecticut.
Connecticut?
Yeah, I say Connecticut.
Connecticut?
Yeah, how do you say it?
Connecticut.
Connecticut?
Mm-hmm. Connecticut.
That hurts. It hurts my face to say it like that. Connecticut.
Well, then people in different areas change their own words, like most people from Baltimore. They don't call it Baltimore.
What do they call it?
Baltimore.
Baltimore?
Mm-hmm.
Never said that.
Yeah, they leave the T out of there completely.
Well, that's like the town that's near here, Hurricane.
Hurricane?
But, I mean, it's...
Most people look at it and say it's Hurricane.
Yeah, are you going to Hurricane, West Virginia? Oh, well, I don't know where that is.
Well, when I lived down in Waycross, there was a town in Georgia just up the tracks from us, and it was spelled A-L-B-A-N-Y.
A-L-B...
A-N-Y.
Albany?
Uh-huh, just like New York, right?
Yeah.
Nuh-uh. Albany.
Albany?
Albany. They'd look at you funny if you said Albany. Albany? Yeah. That's in New York. This is Albany.
You got to talk like the locals.
That's right.
Well, the one thing that we can pronounce is puffery. Puffery. To get back on
HR Puffin Stuff. That's what that right. makes me think of. You remember that show?
It was a musical, wasn't it?
It was a kid's show. HR Puffin Stuff.
I thought it was a musical. Did they sing a lot on that show?
They probably sang, but okay. It wasn't a theater show. It was a kid's show.
Well, the puffery is, like I said, is generally allowed. And in 1984, the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, basically said that puffery does not warrant enforcement action by the commission. The policy basically said that the commission generally will not pursue cases involving obviously exaggerated or puffing representations, i.e., those that the ordinary consumers do not take seriously. And the example they gave was the finest fried chicken in the world.
The best cup of coffee in the world.
Yep, that's right. Well,
it wasn't Forrest Gump. It was some show like that, though. The guy walked up, here's a coffee shop, best cup of coffee in the world. And there across the street was another one, best cup of coffee in the world. How can this be? The two best cups of coffee in the world. I'm standing right in between them.
Well, since we ended on it being the best fried chicken in the world, I think it's only fitting that I call on you now to brief the other case that you said you had looked up that has to deal with mistakes.
Oh, well, and it's funny that I just stumbled across that when we were doing it, but there was the case, there was two cases mm-hmm. that involved chickens.
Mm-hmm.
And it had, apparently did not have a meeting of the mind because, now, are we talking about the case that that delivered the, it specified the chickens had to be between this many pounds, there had to be so many small chickens that were between like 1.5 and 3 pounds, and so many large chickens that were between 3 pounds and 5 pounds or something like that. And they met that criteria. However, they were considered, part of the chickens were considered to be fryers or skewers right. or something.
Well, that's also a case we read in law school, and that's the Fragilement case.
Fragilement?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So in that case, that was the one.
Oh, stewing chickens.
Yeah, stewing chickens.
That's what they said. And they were asking specifically for ones that were not stewing chickens or whatever. But they didn't say that, though.
Right. And the whole interesting thing about this case is that the one kind of chicken were younger and better and more expensive. The other kind were older and cheaper, and they were only fit for stewing, I believe, whereas the other ones were fit for frying and doing whatever you wanted to them. So the price for the chickens, and they only defined them as chickens.
They
didn't define what it was.
Yeah, and then, a chicken's a chicken, a chicken.
Right, and then the price for these was basically less than what the expensive ones would be, but more than what the cheap ones would be. So it was basically like right in the middle. And so what the court basically said is that one company who was supplying the chickens too, they were kind of new to the business, so they hadn't been around long. So basically what the court said is that it was understood that they meant the cheaper chickens because you couldn't actually purchase the more expensive chickens for that price. So
that was their argument, but that's basically the word to the four corners.
Right, but the court actually, I believe in that case, and I didn't actually read that case, you just mentioned it, but I believe the court held that because of those outside circumstances that they were held to the contract basically for the cheaper chickens.
Yeah, it said here's what the difference was. The receivers were expecting broilers and fryers,
mm-hmm.
and the seller sold them. They were expecting broilers and fryers, and they sent them stewing chickens. And I don't know if it was intentional or not, but what I think is kind of strange or funny or more like me, that when they were writing this case, they said the buyer cried foul.
Yes. Somebody.
The buyer cried foul when receiving these chickens. Somebody had a sense of humor when they were writing this up.
Oh, you have to. Whenever you're having trouble finding your place in that and trying to read that case to me, I thought you were choking on that chicken.
Dun-dun-dun. I was choking on the words there because I can't, I don't know the difference between a broiler and a fryer or a stewer.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, if they said we agreed a chicken and you can't just assume, it's like we said, don't assume, put it in writing what you're expecting to get.
Yeah.
And define what's the difference, I guess. You probably have to go as far as defining what's the difference so that you make sure you're getting what you're wanting.
And that's why contracts sometimes get a little verbose and they're really long and you have these long definition sections because you try to really specify things as best you can, because a well-written contract is actually good for both parties, honestly, because it leaves nothing to interpretation. It's spelled out. Everybody knows what's going on. Now,
I'll tell you one that was sketchy, I thought.
What's that?
When Sydney and Justin bought this house.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. In the advertising and in the amenities when they were advertising the house, there was a hot tub out here. Well, then they buy the house and the people remove the hot tub. It wasn't in the contract. When they actually sold the house, it wasn't in there. They advertised it, but it wasn't in the actual contract as being part of the attached property.
Well, that could be whether or not, under each state's law, whether or not a hot tub is considered like a fixture or not. Usually fixtures and real estate contracts like that are defined. And also, usually what goes with the house is defined as well. So,
you know what I think it was?
What's that?
Puffery.
You think it was puffery?
I think the advertising was puffery. So it's okay to puffer, I guess.
It's okay to puffer?
Yeah, they puffered the ad. Don't say fluffy puffer. You don't know what that is, do you?
I have no idea.
That was on the old can. What was that? That was some old game that the girls had when they were young.
I'm sure there's a YouTube video of it somewhere.
And it was a videotape that came with the game or something like that, or I don't know. And it was, don't say fluffy puffer. I don't remember what the rest of it was. Just remember that line.
I've never had a hard time in my life not saying fluffy puffer.
Really?
Yeah. Hmm. It's pretty easy for me. It comes naturally.
I don't know. That comes up for me every once in a while. The girls will do something. I'll say, don't say fluffy puffer. Dad.
Oh, Dad. Well, that's going to bring us to
Legal Briefs.
Legal Briefs is a part of the show where we go over some of the different legal terms that we discussed. And usually I ask Tommy if he can remember what they mean. And this episode is chock full of them. There's so many to choose from.
I haven't even understood the episode. I don't know how I'm going to know the words.
Well, let's go with void ab initio.
Void ab initio. That means that the contract is void without prejudice.
I don't really know what that means.
It means that there was no meeting of the minds, so the contract is void.
Well, basically, void ab initio means void from the outset. If you think about ab initio, it means initio, meaning initiation or beginning. Void from the beginning is probably the quickest, shortest answer there.
It was a bad contract to start with.
That's right.
Nobody knew what the hell was going on.
Yeah. Nobody knows what's going
on. That's when two dudes try to draw up a contract, they don't have a lawyer dude involved.
Collateral issue.
Well, it doesn't have to do with money. We clarified that part.
That's right.
A collateral issue has to do with other things outside the realm of the contract or something like that. I don't know.
Well, no, collateral issue are terms in the contract which there might be a misunderstanding about, but they're not material to the contract itself. So it could be some other issue that you've in the contract that just not, I mean, you might not have an agreement on it, but it really doesn't matter because it's not the meat and potatoes of the
incidental to the contract.
Exactly. You've got the amount, the number, the type, the delivery, all that kind of stuff in there.
So the main thrust of the contract was taken care of.
That's right.
There's some other incidental parts that they're not going to hold you responsible for.
Right, and that doesn't make a contract voidable just because it's like this other stuff. So, So can you briefly surmise for me, or give me a brief of the Peerless case?
In the Peerless case, it appears that Ruffles was wanting to sell to Hacklesworth some cotton. And they agreed on the price and the quality and the ship. And the ship was called the Peerless. Unbeknownst to both parties, though Peerless was not Peerless. It had a twin. They were separated at birth. So the cotton arrived in October. No, the cotton did not arrive in October. And Hacklesworth was waiting for it at the dock and said, damn, he didn't send me my cotton. And he went back home. In December, a ship arrived, named Peerless, with the cotton. and Hacklesworth had already given up and secured something else to use instead of cotton. He was going to make his clothes out of burlap, and he shortly went out of business. But the cotton sat there, and then Ruffles said, "Why didn't you buy my cotton?" Hacklesworth said, "I had to buy burlap. Your cotton didn't come." He said, "Well, it came now." "Well, yeah, but we agreed." "Yeah, but it came on another Peerless. I was on the first Peerless. You were at Peerless, too." "Well, I didn't know about that." And so nobody was happy. They all went home sad.
They sued each other.
And who won? We don't know. Neither won.
Peerless. Peerless won.
Peerless won.
Yeah, that's basically what happened. And that case, besides its comedic relief, is an example of mutual mistake. So
mutual mistake and ambiguity within a contract.
Yeah. The last term, actually, there's two more terms. I take that back. The next to last term.
Darn, I only studied one more.
Parole evidence rule.
That's word evidence, and that's when people try to enter words basically that are outside the written words that are on the contract.
Right.
Oral things that they think should have been included or were implicated or something that weren't.
Yeah, and if you want to sound all lawyery, you say, those are words that are outside the four corners of the contract. You always throw that four corners in there because it's a good term.
There's a restaurant I ate out up in Grafton, West Virginia, that was named the Four Corners, but I don't think it had to do with law stuff.
Probably not. The food would not be very good.
No.
And the last term, puffery.
Puffery. Well, it's not buggery.
Nope, definitely not buggery.
Puffery has to do with making claims about things that the normal person would not expect to be true and stuff like that, like the world's greatest cup of coffee or the greatest, best car I've ever sold or something like that. You can't go back and say, it wasn't the best car. I've had better coffee. It doesn't matter.
Best cup of coffee. You serious, Clark?
There was a couple other things that in contract law that I came across that I thought might be good to clarify. One is that you have to have both sides have, what am I trying to say? Something that they both have to have some skin in the game.
Consideration?
Yeah, they both have to give proper consideration.
That's right.
So if you do such and such, like you don't break any laws by the time you're 18, I'll give you $1,000.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's no real consideration because the person's not supposed to break laws anyway. So,
right.
The guy then can't turn around and say, well, you owe me $1,000. He can say, no, well, we had a contract. Well, there's no consideration.
There's a whole interesting thing, like talking about like those hole-in-one contests at golf events, like, you know, whether or not if you hit a hole-in-one, you get a car and things like that.
Right.
Consideration is actually kind of an interesting topic in contract law, too. We could probably do a whole episode on that.
Oh, so. Okay. Well, then I won't get into that. We were talking about contracts, and I know that there's things that have to be in there, meeting of the minds.
Yep.
Some things like that, consideration.
You got to have certain things that are within the four corners of the contract.
Yes.
Doesn't that sound smart?
Yes.
Within the four corners of the contract.
You like, that's just like that knock for knock you got hung up on.
Yeah.
Well, that's just like knocking you in the head.
That's my fallback position.
Wooden head.
That's my fallback position if anybody talks to me about something like that. Well, it's not in the four corners.
And they don't know what to say to that then.
Yeah.
Huh?
Like, well, yeah, he's right. It's not in the four corners. This guy's good.
Four corners? I used to play that game on the playground. That was four square.
Hey, you said no popcorn. Did you ever play that? With popcorn was where you juggle the ball in your hand and then you slam it down.
Well, no spiking.
No spiking.
Say that. Yeah.
No bus stop. That was a bus stop.
Is that where you carry it and then do it?
I think so. I don't know. I haven't played four square in a while. need to get back on that. Get my four square.
You don't even see four squares out in the playgrounds anymore. I don't think it's allowed. Probably they don't let kids do anything. A playground, you have to have like mattresses laid out on the ground and stuff like that. And I don't know. You're not supposed to have fun anymore. We survived. I mean, we might have lumpy heads and stuff, but we survived.
Yeah. A few nasal surgeries later, my nose is almost straight again.
Yeah. They don't make kids like they used to. They were tough back in my day. You went head first, just like our parachuting activities. You land head first.
We went hard into the paint.
If you can't win, draw blood.
famous Tommy Smurl quote. If you're going to foul him, don't let him score.
That's right. If you're going to foul him, get your money's worth.
Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Doctor, Lawyer, Indian Chief.
And thanks to the McElroy Stable of Podcasts for the use of their recording studio. Their podcasts include Mabim Bam, Sawbones, and Still Buffering, as well as many other fine offerings. And please, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you liked us. If you didn't, well then, not so much.
You're not supposed to say that.
You always edit that out though, right?
Usually.
Good.
This has been Court Appointed. I'm Mike Meadows, your co-host. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I...